This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Warren E. Miltier, Jr. to discuss his new book, Beyond Slavery's Shadow, Free People of Color in the South, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2021. Trends in scholarship and our desire to critically engage with the institution of slavery's profound impact on American society often lead us to focus on people of color who were enslaved. But my guest directs our attention to the people of color who were free colonists and later Americans, and the complex web of intersecting values that led to significant inconsistencies in how they were treated and the institutions they built for themselves. Dr. Miltier does not deny that many white Southerners prized the racial hierarchy that placed them above people of color in multiple phases of their lives. Yet Beyond Slavery's Shadow insists that they also recognize other forms of hierarchy, such as gender, wealth, reputation, occupation, and family connections. And by engaging how these and other forms of hierarchy intersected with racial categorization, Dr. Miltier creates a rich history of people of color in the South. Actually, I found this to sort of be like a history of law, colonization, labor, immigration, taxation, sort of everything. He rejects laws and political rhetoric as the only evidence for discerning the viewpoints of everyday people, and he looks to place everyday people in their wider political and social contexts by drawing from various sources from the colonial period through the Civil War. Beyond Slavery's Shadow explains how diverse political and social attitudes could coexist, and I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. Warren E. Miltier, Jr. to the program. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and he's also the author of North Carolina's Free People of Color, 1715 to 1885, published by LSU Press last year. Warren, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, like, one of the premises of your book is that free people of color are understudied and sort of dwarfed in some way by our focus on people who are enslaved. And you end the book with an observation that we've simplified our understanding of race from the 17th to the 19th centuries by not thinking about all peoples. And that impacts our wider understandings of race. So there's a lot happening in this in the book. But because it is understudied, and because you acknowledge that throughout the book, so lots of people who are listening right now don't actually know what we're going to focus on. So before we talk about how the scholarship on this developed and the rest, let me just start with some basics. Who are the free people of color who were in the colonies and later in the U.S., and how were they distributed across the country?
Okay, so three people of color that I'm talking about in this book or writing about in this book come from a diversity of backgrounds. Most of them are people of either African and or Native American descent. And, you know, to what degree they're connected to one group or another varies pretty widely. And as far as free people of color and how they became free, so there were people who were born free, and then there were people who were enslaved that became free through the process of manumission. And so people of color could become free through the process of manumission in a lot of different ways. They could purchase their own freedom. They could negotiate their freedom in exchange for labor. There are people who were freed when other individuals would purchase them. So maybe a family member, a friend, some free people of color even would hire other individuals to pay for their freedom, then they would pay them back later. So there were a lot of different ways that a person could become manumitted. And then as far as free birth is concerned, in most of the colonies, for most of the time period in which I'm studying, if your mother was free, you were free. And a lot of the families in the colonial period in particular that were freeborn families gained that freedom because they were a descendant of a white woman or a Native American woman. And in most colonies, if you had that background, then you were automatically considered free.
There's another, thank you so much. There's another aspect of this that you highlight throughout the book, which is who colonized which part of the landmass. So you talk a little bit about the difference between being under French, Spanish, or English rules. And I was wondering if you'd just say a little bit about that, because I found it fascinating.
Yeah, so I first of all will say that I decided to look at the situation of free people of color in these different empires, partially because it hadn't been looked at very closely, especially in the larger studies of free people of color. But I also thought it was important because it does, these differences in location affect the lives of free people of color and what's possible. So, for instance, I talk about in the Spanish Empire that the rules around manumission are a little bit different than those in the English, and the same will go for the French. Also, in the earlier parts of my book, I talk about how the contest between these empires impacted the lives of enslaved people who would become free, because the colonial conflicts created opportunities for enslaved people to become free because they could run from one empire into another empire and then gain their freedom that way, which was not a typical form of manumission, but it did exist and was important to shaping the colonial dynamic between these empires and also the lives of the individuals that I discuss.
You mentioned earlier that most of these legal regimes were tracing status through the mother. And one of the things that I noticed throughout this book is the care that you take with gender throughout. You know, it's very mainstreaming, and it's also very careful to point out when it is that patriarchy can be something that is used by free people, free men of color, to create their own forms of hierarchy. But and we'll talk about that later. But in terms of tracing things through the mother, that's fairly unusual in English law, at least, which I'm more knowledgeable about than Spanish or French law. Can you say a little bit more about how that comes about? That the identity has to be the mother and not the father.
Well, I mean, it comes about in the development of slave laws in the colonies and trying to figure out exactly how you're going to define who will be enslaved and who will not. And I think also it's just something very practical to it. It's easier to understand who a person's mother is when it comes to enslavement versus trying to figure out who the father is, trace that person, and then determine whether an enslaved person is enslaved or if you're dealing with a free person. So you could imagine how difficult it would be if you're, say, the person who's enslaving a woman and she has a child and you don't know whether that child is your property or not. It's much more simple, I think, under this particular system. But in the reverse, of course, it also creates a situation where free people, if their mothers are free, that they're free. But at the same time, we see some interesting things happen with that I talk about as far as like servitude status, that although some children are born free, they also are inheriting the servitude status of their mother, which often leaves them to many years of unpaid work and maybe even in certain cases, generations of people being tied into this system of unpaid work.
That was a shocking, number in the book, 31, that women who had a child without being married, that child who had nothing whatsoever, as you note in the book, nothing whatsoever to do with this, must be indentured for 30, 31, I can't remember which one it is. And that was extraordinary. Another one of the remarkable moments in the book where you see the intersection of race and gender and how it is that they are punishing any sort of sexual relations outside of marriage, in addition to any sort of mixed racial sexual relations. Like you do such a good job on that, but I found that part of the book actually awful. I had to close up for a little bit to let that sink in. I mentioned the previous literature. Let's talk a little bit about when is it that historians and others begin studying free peoples of color? How do they do it? What's wrong with the way, or what's problematic about the way that they start? And so sort of take us through your field up until the time that you write this book.
Yeah, so I would say that the first serious studies of free people of color are published in the early 20th century. There's a study about free people of color in Virginia, one about free people of color in Maryland. And I would say that there are several problems with those studies. While I think in general they are pretty well researched, especially for the time period and the access that those historians would have had to records, some of the undertones as far as respecting the subjects that are being studied suggests that these scholars are their approach is a bit problematic. They don't see all of the possibilities in their subjects as far as being human beings. And I would say the next generation of scholars that are coming in, say, the 1930s, 1940s, this is where we see the first series studies by scholars of color. Those scholars are definitely impacted by the people who are writing in the early 20th century, especially in the structure of the books. So most of these early texts, whether it's, you know, the beginning of the 20th century or somewhere more towards the middle of the 20th century, they're more thematic, which is not necessarily problematic, but there's a structure that's clearly being copied over and over again. And in some of these books, there seems to be a conclusion that free people of color are kind of stuck in this terrible social, political situation. It gets worse as time goes on. And ultimately, I don't think there's enough flexibility in the understanding of free people of color's positions in society that they can have multiple positions as a group. there, I mean, so the, I guess this is the thing, it's tricky because in a lot of these works, the authors will make arguments that don't always fit with their evidence. So that's very curious. And that actually continues on when we get even to the 1970s with Ira Berlin and his book Slaves Without Masters, which is a text that is widely cited even today because it's basically a synthesis of this earlier work. But then Berlin did add some additional material to his study of free people of color. And in Berlin's work, after looking at these other works and coming to his own conclusions, one of the main arguments that he makes is that free people of color, their status is very similar to that of enslaved people. It's almost like the state owns them versus an individual right. master holding people. But at the same time, Berlin throughout the book will hint at the fact that, well, there's some class differences between free people of color or among free people of color, or that they have different types of jobs that lead to different outcomes in their lives, that some have slightly different social networks than others. But ultimately, he comes to this same conclusion. So it's kind of curious how he developed that argument about Slaves Without Masters that is very much tied to how the book is understood by, I think, most historians and even the larger public, those who've been able to access the book.
It seems so similar to in the 20s. It seems like it's the study of people, but a people without who've had autonomy taken away, but yet the historians themselves have taken their autonomy away by talking about them not as the protagonists, not as people who have a contribution to these communities and to these social relationships. It's that's absent. And it's interesting that that hangs on for so long. And what's so clear about your book is that the focus is there, is not that free people of color could do anything they wanted, because you're very clear about the limitations that they were working under. But you're also talking about different humans in different groups, in different places, all making very different decisions about how to organize. So there's a lot of pluralism, but that seems to me part of the point. The point is that you can't talk about autonomy without, sorry, I'm being maybe too much of a political theorist here, but that seems to be a big contribution of your book. You mention the documents. So what did they have in the 20s? What did they get in the 70s? And what is it that you have now that is different? Like the back of the book has a list of the resources that you looked at, and it's head spinning. I mean, it's clear through the writing of the book that it had to be like that. But can you describe a little bit for listeners what it is they had and what it is that you use to make these observations about everyday life that's different from what's in the legal statute books or printed in a newspaper?
I think the early generation of scholars that were working at the beginning of the 20th century, the limit that they had when it came to sources was about the lack of, a central location for their archives. So a lot of the materials that are now maybe located in one state archive were spread out across the state in different counties. So they would have to go from county courthouse to county courthouse looking for these materials and putting that all together. And because it takes so much time, it definitely limits what you can do. Although I think it's amazing to look at what they found despite their situation when it came to the spread of sources. You can tell that these people actually were probably funded fairly well to be able to go around and do what they did.
And you say it was very regional too, because of this method that if you were going to have to go to the courthouse and copy stuff out because you didn't have a phone to take a photograph of or a photocopier, that would, limit what it is you could actually do. And people became very, very specialized about these one community or one part of a state, not even an entire state. I mean, these are big states that we're talking about.
Right, exactly. And so that's why you see pretty much all of the studies before the 1970s are state level studies. And then, of course, there are articles that are published that are maybe about a single city or county or something like that. Now, interestingly, I did have the opportunity to hear John Hope Franklin discuss how he did his research for The Free Negro in North Carolina, which was published in the 1940s. And it's a funny story because, in a sense, he had to go to the state archives in North Carolina, in Raleigh, North Carolina. And at the time, it was segregated. So he was not allowed to sit in the same area with everybody else. But apparently, it was to his benefit that that was the case, because they put him in the stacks. And so he had to just hang out in the stacks all day and had very easy access to the materials in a way that people who were seated at the tables would not. But nevertheless, John Hope Franklin,
that's a great story.
Yeah, he's still operating, you know, in this situation in which segregation is dominant in North Carolina. And so it would have been very difficult for him to go around the courthouses, things of that nature. I mean, it's actually still difficult today to go around courthouses to some extent, depending on where you're going. And so I guess in one way, like I said, he benefited, because by the time he's doing his research in the 1940s, a lot of material from the counties has been located or centralized at the state archives in Raleigh. But at the same time, it also gives him only this one little space to really operate in. And of course, I was able to go much further than that. And then by the time we get to the 1970s with Ira Berlin, so I'm assuming, you know, that Berlin actually probably did some of his research in the 1960s. Berlin has a lot more secondary literature, of course, to work with than, say, somebody like John Hope Franklin, who was writing in the 1940s. And so he's able to take all of these different books, and then he adds a lot of newspapers from microfilm to that research. He does go to other repositories around the country and finds letter collections. He uses a lot of books that would, I guess, like law books, basically, that would give him some sense of what the different laws were. And he ends up depending on those books quite a bit to figure out what the opinions are of people of the time. And, you know, I don't know if he had had more time or more money, if he would have necessarily changed his argument. I'm not sure, because I think some of the evidence he has, he could have easily have made a different argument. But that's the situation that I think he was working with. And after Berlin writes his study, we see historians kind of going back towards local studies. Some of them are very local. So again, there are books now about counties or cities versus writing books about states or whole entire regions. And so one of those key works is Melvin Patrick Ely's Israel and Appomattox, which looks at one county in Virginia. Now, I think what Ely was able to do that some of the other scholars were not is that because he focused on one county, he could go through various types of records that I don't think some of these other scholars had engaged with, because it depends on the location, but you would have not just records related to maybe criminals, but there are records of the poorhouse in a community. There are records about registration. So free people of color in the 19th century in Virginia were supposed to register, so he could work with those records. It's just he had a wider assortment of different types of records to use because he focused on one place, whereas people who are trying to look at a more wide geographic span are having to, you know, pick and choose what collections they have time to engage with.
So before we get to the argument of your book, just tell me shortly what kinds of things are you using? Are some of them going back to things that need to be looked at with fresh eyes? Are some of these things new? Is digitizing make it easier for you to access things? Because part of what you're contributing here is to think broadly about free people of color in the South, not to provide a regional view or examination, but to really think more globally. So what does it look like? And also, if you would share your an aha moment in the archives, that'd be awesome as well.
Yeah, so I guess it's a tricky question because my process has been very long. Because of course I wrote another book about free people of color before this one that we're talking about today. So by doing research on a state, I was able to get some sense of the different types of records that existed within that state. And yeah, I think I did benefit, especially when it comes to digitization of like newspapers and even some books. It makes the process faster to locate law books and things of that nature versus having to sit in the library and flip through every single book. You can use, you know, a search term and find things very quickly. So I definitely have to credit the technology to some extent on that end. But then going back to this earlier study that I had worked on for North Carolina, because I was familiar with the types of records that were in North Carolina, I was able to apply that knowledge when I went to other states, and it made it relatively easy to figure out where records about free people of color are. Because there's certain types of records, you know, oh, free people of color rarely appear in these records. Don't spend your time digging through these. Whereas, you know, free people of color are going to be in another type of record, and you should definitely spend time looking at those particular records if you want to know more about free people of color in that particular state or location where I was doing research. And as far as something interesting in the archive, that is really tricky. Yeah, I mean, I've seen some creepy things in the archive, like hair from dead people. I've seen that kind of stuff. That's probably probably the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Okay, these are not cleaned up records. These are sitting there and with dust and hair. Okay, yeah, no, that's visual. That's great for a podcast. Well, let's turn to the argument of the book. The book is arranged chronologically. You start in the colonial period. We've talked a little bit about this, but I always struggle with history books. Just full disclosure as to, you know, whether to try to run through them the way they were written, or to deal with them thematically. I think I'd like to start with a little bit about each of these periods because I think it creates this arc that takes us to the end of the book. So with your permission, I'll ask you, tell us a little bit about what things look like in the colonial period. You've already said there's differences because of the Spanish, the French, the English, relationships with indigenous peoples, which are quite different in different areas. But tell us a little bit more about how many free people of color are there in this period, roughly. You note in the book that they're very different, and that in the cities they're perhaps wealthier and more connected to the economy of slavery, whereas in the Upper South things look a lot different. So just a couple of insights before we turn to the Revolutionary War and how things change for free people of color during that period.
Yeah, so in the colonial period, it's really difficult to actually pin down how many free people of color were in the South in any particular location. Based on just their appearance in the records, it seems very likely that Virginia and Maryland, which are two states or colonies at this time, that will have large populations of free people of color throughout this period that I study, probably were the leading areas, even in the colonial period. Because you see a lot of white indentured servants who are recorded having children out of wedlock with people of color. And so their children end up being like this early generation of free people of color in the colonies. And then, you know, I think North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, Delaware are probably behind those two. And exactly where they are, it's really tricky to figure that out. And then as far as like their locations and towns and cities, now, of course, they're not many. There's many towns or cities in the, you know, colonial South, but there's clearly a presence of free people of color in say Charleston, or maybe the slightly more urban, if we want to call anything in colonial Virginia urban, but yeah, it's the slightly more urban, more settled areas of Virginia and the eastern part of Virginia, you tend to see more references of free people of color there for sure. And the same will go probably eastern Maryland and that area. But even, you know, Baltimore is not much of anything in the colonial period.
So as we get to the Revolutionary War, what do free people of color do during the war? How does the war affect their status, their choices?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on in the American Revolutionary, during the American Revolution, and in that general, like, late 1700s period. So one major change that I think is really important is that you have a shifting of boundaries with the empires following the Seven Years' War. So areas that were once controlled by the French end up being taken by the Spanish. The areas that were controlled by the Spanish end up being taken over by the British. And in the case of the areas that were taken over by the Spanish that used to be in the hands of the French, particularly the Louisiana, the introduction of Spanish law creates opportunities for manumission that had not existed under the French empire. And so you have a steady growth of free people of color in Louisiana that had not been there before. And of course, that would make Louisiana a central location, especially in the Deep South, for free people of color later in the 19th century. Yeah, I think another important shift that takes place during this revolutionary period is in the British colonies, and these colonies, of course, are going to be those that will make up the early United States, but there's a convergence of ideas about freedom that you could tie to the revolution, but also there's discussions within religious communities about whether slavery is right and fits with their understanding of their religion. And these two issues or two discussions come together and lead to the liberalization of manumission laws in many of the southern colonies, especially those in the upper South. And that provides a great opportunity for enslaved people to seek out their own freedom and the freedom of their family members. And so, of course, they do this in a variety of different ways. As I talked about it, there are so many ways to become manumitted. But the major change is the ideas that people are now, there are people who are willing to listen to the idea that maybe slavery is wrong. Ultimately, we know that there is a pushback and that there are large numbers of people who are very much invested in slavery and want to keep it going in the revolutionary period and beyond.
Yeah, and you do a great job in that chapter of sort of individualizing the various landowners, people who, again, for Christian reasons, decide I should not be holding property in persons. And that's so well done, the way those two things come through. I should add for those people who are thinking about reading the book that this is a book that just reads. I actually just sat on a couch and read it, not taking notes on it. So it's a great read as a serious reader, as somebody who studies this period. I made lots of tabs to go back to add things for the American Political Thought class that I teach and research that I would do. So, and it's also a book that would be accessible to students. So this is a book open to serious readers, very important for scholars, but also something that is accessible to not a freshman, maybe undergraduate, but to an undergraduate under some, you know, with some help. You mentioned the backlash. What happens in the revolutionary period that creates this backlash, and what are some of the highlights of that?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, even as these laws about manumission are liberalizing, or people are liberalizing these laws, they're changing the laws and amending them to make it easier for enslaved people to become free people, there are people who are deeply interested in maintaining slavery as it is and even potentially expanding it. And of course, as we get into the 19th century, we see the addition of new states that are open to slavery, and those are new opportunities for people who are slaveholders, even in the Upper South, because of course the Upper South will be a place that exports large numbers of enslaved people to the Deep South. So there's this business opportunity there, and those individuals don't want the manumission liberalization to go too far and end up destroying the possibilities for them. So they push back. And also there is groups of people who are concerned with maintaining and strengthening the racial hierarchy. And so I argue that these people who I describe as white supremacists and these pro-slavery people kind of work together to create an environment in the South that is more difficult for free people of color to navigate. Some of them, I think that is the actual purpose, is to make life difficult for free people of color. For others, I think they're just doing this to appease certain constituents or to show that they are trying to strengthen the importance of slavery altogether, and they target free people of color as a way of doing that.
One of the points that you make throughout the book is that there's the laws that are on the books, and there's this radical white supremacist rhetoric that appears in newspapers. But what you try to do is use the sources that will allow you to see, well, what's actually happening in terms of how people marry and who gets recognized. So, for example, even though a community is not supposed to recognize a marriage, they do. Can you say a little bit about these legal regimes and how free people of color negotiate them, and as well as white people, but how they're negotiated at this more local level?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of the legislation dealing with free people of color is being produced at the state level. So it's coming out of the state legislatures, being signed off by the governor. But ultimately, it's up to local officials at the county level or in parish level, wherever you are, city level, to take these laws and make them reality. And in many cases, they do that, but in many cases, they don't. And I think each community and the leadership in that community had their own reasons for making decisions to enforce or not enforce these difficult laws. Some of them, I think, were just not very practical. So there were restrictions placed on the movement of free people of color into different communities. And you really need an enforcement regime in order to support restrictions on people's movement. And the state didn't provide anything like that. No, there was no serious attempt made to, especially outside of like port cities. So there was some enforcement at a port city, because it's easy to police people coming off a boat. It's much more difficult to police people crossing a state border, going through a swamp, trying to go from one state to another. And so I think that's part of what's going on. And then two, there are, you know, kinship connections between white people and free people of color across the South. And those connections made a huge difference in the lives of the free people of color who could call on them when they were needed. Or just friendship connections, family connections that may have gone back for generations. All of those relationships played an important role in how free people of color experience day-to-day life. And often that day-to-day life did contrast with what you would assume was going on based on the laws and the laws in the book, on the books.
So by the first decades of the 19th century, what we have is this, as you've described it, this hardening of white supremacy, changes in the laws. Meanwhile, a local negotiation of that. By the time we get to sort of the middle, well, it's past the middle of your book, but the rebellion and you talk about not Nat Turner. You start with other people that I've not heard of, which is why I'm sort of struggling to remember their names here. But what is it that happens after this period of change and yet equilibrium at the same time that sort of defines this new era as we move through the 19th century?
Right. So, yeah, in the book I discuss the 1831 Nat Turner Rebellion that took place in Southampton County, Virginia. And in my discussion, I focus on the immediate effects of that rebellion and how certain free people of color in Virginia and North Carolina in particular were affected by the aftermath. So there were free people of color who were arrested, harassed, things of that nature. But I also use that particular section of the book to discuss how political figures and people who oppose the presence of free people of color try to weaponize that particular moment for their benefit. So there are laws passed in many parts of the South that add additional limits to the lives of free people of color, additional restrictions. There's support for the colonization of free people of color in Africa because there's individuals who want to remove free people of color from the South. And so you see they were able to be somewhat successful after the rebellion. But I look at the rebellion as more of an opportunity for them to respond politically than necessarily that they were coming up with new ideas because of the rebellion itself. It was more like these were old ideas that they had failed to get through their state legislatures before, and now with this moment, they could make it happen. That's how I'm looking at it. And following that discussion, I continue to talk about the different ways that they are trying to manipulate the law to target free people of color and further support this agenda. And again, they're often passing laws that are not new. So there's disfranchisement of free men of color in Tennessee and North Carolina that takes place in the 1830s. That's not a new concept. Disfranchising free men of color had been going on since the late 1700s, and there were other moments that happened. So the Nat Turner Rebellion, in other words, didn't create that idea for lawmakers in North Carolina and Tennessee. And they'd actually tried that before, and it was in the 1830s though, that they were finally able to make it happen. And there are several other issues that come up amongst lawmakers and extreme ideas. And I trace them throughout the chapter, all these crazy attempts to curb the lives of free people of color, from, you know, all the way from restricting them from the right to vote to trying to enslave free people of color. All these ideas are floating out there in the...
A while back, wow, it's a year maybe, I talked to Gilda Daniels about her book on voter suppression. You know, she's not a historian, she's a lawyer, but what she's trying to say is that so many of the things that we see today in terms of voter suppression are recycled. And I felt similarly about your chapter of showing how everything that you outlined earlier, because you're talking about very early colonial practices, comes back, is recycled, is radicalized, et cetera. But you're also really focused on resistance. And so I'd like you to say a couple of things. And there is some movement. Some people do leave. I mean, this is like a natural reaction to violence. But some people resist. Talk a little bit about the institutions that they use to resist. And also, as I said earlier, you know, you're very sensitive to gender, and talk a little bit about how resistance plays out across this period.
Right. Yeah. So the resistance can vary in shape and form, but of course you see resistance through the courts. So some free people of color will challenge the laws, or they at least push back when local officials try to enforce these discriminatory laws against them. And they will have lawyers who come with often very interesting approaches to challenging the laws. Often it's just to get them as individuals out of the situation. But nevertheless,
they're
very creative, but nevertheless, they are pushing back. They're not just sitting there and letting these laws totally control their lives if they have an opportunity to get out of the situation. And of course, it's much easier to get out of these situations if you have the money and connections to make it happen than if you're a person who doesn't have that. So that's one major way.
Yeah, and say just a little bit about that, because class is really important throughout this book, and you emphasize that, you know, there are free people of color who have generations of education and a certain form of affluence and social capital that they and financial capital that they can put to use. I mean, we all know lawyers are expensive and often use these forms of problems to create, you know, a way to make their own living. So just say a little bit about how it is that the least well off fare in this period.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've got free people of color, of course, who are pretty well-to-do. They're planters. Some of them are even slaveholders, and they're enslaving other people and using that as a way to make more money. And those people are able to, in particular, those people are able to, you know, accumulate the resources that allow them to overcome laws such as in most of the South. Free people of color are not allowed to testify in court against white people. Yet, there are free people of color who can sue white people and win judgments against them without being able to, you know, directly speak against those individuals in court. They're able to find ways around that. And even in other ways, I did mention, I think, one case where there's a free man of color who basically manipulates his tenants into voting in certain ways. He can't vote, but he has white tenants who can vote, and he pushes them in a certain direction, which is not uncommon in that time period for wealthy people to tell their tenants how to vote.
It's one of the arguments against letting people without property vote is that they will be manipulated by the people who have complete power over their lives. It was one of the examples for why women shouldn't vote either. Noah, you show so many creative moments. In particular, very early on in the book, you note that there's a real difference between using a court in terms of bringing a lawsuit and talking about the law in terms of its enforcement. And I feel like that's a really important thread as somebody who thinks about the history of law a lot throughout this book. Like in this period, it's not just bringing people to court, which is interesting. You can bring somebody to court, but you can't be a witness in your own case. But also the challenging of enforcement and trying to get it before using the threat of law. I found that to be really, really fascinating. Tell me a little bit about churches. They play a role throughout the book, but in particular in this period. So just say a little bit more about how men and women of free color use the churches, the extent to which sometimes women are included and sometimes they are excluded.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, free people of color, I think, see the church as both a place where they are potentially oppressed, but also a place where there's a great deal of opportunity for them. So in certain cases, you have free people of color who are going to churches with white people. And in those churches, often they are limited in their power to control the affairs of the church. They're not allowed to be officials in their churches. Or if they are, they are officials only within a segregated part of the congregation. And so there's some pushback against that. And some free people of color decide to found their own churches where they can have more autonomy. And within those churches, you find, I think, greater opportunities for leadership among free men of color in particular, but also free women of color. Free women of color play important roles in creating financial support for these institutions in particular. So they're doing a lot of fundraising for the churches and sometimes the schools that are attached to their churches, even though they don't have like a lead, you know, the official leadership role. They can't be a deacon in the church per se, but they're still doing quite a bit of work.
So Warren, as we're kind of wrapping up here, what, obviously you've been working on this study a long time. And most of the writers that I talk to have been working on their books longer than they anticipated and perhaps longer than they wished. And I want to ask you about what you're working on next. But as this is now in print, how do you see it moving our understanding of race forward? What do you want people to walk away from the book with, such that they look at the world differently and think a little bit in a more nuanced way about American racial history?
Yeah, well, I think that I want people to consider what freedom really means and all of the different types of experiences that fit under this term freedom. So we tend to think about, oh, freedom is this place, or this it's this idea that creates equality amongst all of us. And I think that we see in the case of free people of color that that's not actually what's going on for them in comparison to other people who are considered free in the society, but also among that small group of people, free people, there's quite a bit of difference, and that we have to take into serious consideration how other forms of status or positions within other hierarchies are influencing the day-to-day lives of not just free people of color, but all people who are living in the United States during the time that I'm researching. And even today, you know, we have these many of these same differences still impacting our society, that, you know, your family history matters as to where you fit in society, no matter whether you're a person of color or not.
No, and I, as I said earlier, the way I read the book, and I'm not sure this was your intent, is that I kept feeling like, wow, I am getting a primer on taxation history in the United States and the way it is that localities tax people, tax free people, tax the way one could say that a baby born out of wedlock went to the state, that sort of a claim, like when you're talking about, well, what does freedom really mean? And that's something that's applying not just to free people of color, but to free white people. Then there's different rules for indigenous people. I really felt like this book was so layered in what it was teaching me about labor history and taxation and really in thinking about caste as well. What are you working on now? And and tell me where you are in the process.
Yeah, so that's a tricky question too. I'm kind of looking through a lot of different possibilities. I've done a little research I'll say this, that I don't think I'm done researching Free People of Color, exactly where that's going to go next. Still working on that. And it brought there, you know, several different areas of the lives of free people of color that I think I could easily investigate. And so just the question becomes, like, which one am I going to focus on first? But I think that's all I can say about it right now.
Well, you just wrote two huge books and published them in 2 years. So no matter how much research you did and how long it took you, it's always excellent to talk to an author who had a book come out last year and this year. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I enjoyed reading this book so much and I learned so much from it. So thank you so much for the care that you took writing it and for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you for reading it. And thank you for having me on.